The Football Pod with Paddy and Andy.
We lost that championship game against Donegal. We didn't lose a game for 7 years after that. I tell you, we were angry after that game. Dublin came back, I remember, in 2015. It was, we're putting this right.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
Friday Night Racing.
On Off the Ball.
Brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Love every racing moment. Visit hri.ie.
Right, you're very welcome along to this week's edition of Friday Night Racing here on Off the Ball, brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Love every racing moment. Visit hri.ie. Make sure to follow the Twitter account at HRI Racing or the hashtag, and the hashtag is Every Racing Moment. On a quiet Tuesday night in Roscommon, a little heralded horse called Afaya had a milestone victory. Watch this.
Furlongs to race. Afaya out in front, chased by Geological, Trouba out in the centre of the course, Big Baby Bull, wider still is Bringsty. But heading with about a furlong and a half to race, Ophaya is still out in front, clear by a few lengths. Big Baby Bull leads the chase. Trouba is third, Geological behind him, Bringsty, Privilege trying to stay on. But Ophaya out in front, inside the final furlong from Big Baby Bull in second. A good battle on for the third money, but Ophaya out in front. It's a double on the day for Colin Keane and 1,000 winners in the career of Ger Lyons.
1,000 winners in the career of Ger Lyons. Ger, how are you?
Hi, Ger. Good to hear you again.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, listen, we'll take it. I think it's more a sign of your age than it is anything else. But it's a good target to hit.
I was going
to
say an overnight success after 27 years of trying.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, an overnight success after 56 years. Yeah, and no, it's great. The texts and the messages have been great, and listen, I love Roscommon. Roscommon, the people were very good, and it was great that Michael, I mean, I hadn't the manners to go down to him, but he had the sign up and everything, and I'm just delighted for him that we had the winner there, because they went above and beyond, and they're lovely people down there. It's a lovely track, well ran, and I mean, I ran Lightning Pearl down there before she won her grade one, and I just love the track.
This is Micheál Finner and Ger.
Yeah, they're just good people.
Yeah, proper tractor.
I know that you're supposed to be a cold-blooded killer and you're in the middle of a season and you're not supposed to stop and think about things. But when you hit a milestone like this, in your quiet moments of reflection, are you thinking, wow, actually, you know, it probably is about time that I looked back a little bit and you know, walk back through some of those steps in the journey I've been on to get here?
I'd love to say that's what I do. But unfortunately, I don't. I'm sure it will. I will at some stage through my life, you know, do it. But unfortunately, I got in the zone of the last five or whatever years of just onto the next one and just keep putting the head down and plowing ahead. And then when the season's over, just collapse and die in a heap and get into the fetal position, and then resume normality again back in January, you know. But I'm not trivializing it or anything like that, but genuinely, I just think this game is about the people who stay at it the longest. Do you know what I mean? There's, you know, if people come in and they crack it and the press pipe them up and this and that and the other, and I always say, talk to me in 5 years, see if they're still around. You know, I've great admiration for the folk who stay at it, because it's tough. No more than your gig is or Johnny's gig is, or anybody's gig is. It's, you know, life is tough, but it's very tough. It's very tough trying to tread the waters over here in racing, you know.
I actually think your gig is one of the harder gigs when you think about the fact that the animals need looked after 24 hours a day. Like, anybody who's ever had kids understands that, yeah, it's kind of a lifelong commitment that you have there, but at least they reach a point of being somewhat self-sufficient. The horses never really do. And while there's an off season, the horse still needs to be fed and trained and maintained. And like our gigs, the light goes off and we get to go home. But when you go home, you've got to go to work.
Yeah, my work is home. And like we laugh at, you know, sometimes we come in and it has to be announced to us that it's a bank holiday. We don't know it's a bank holiday. Oh God, yeah, it's a bank holiday. We're at Nace, you know. Why are they not? Why is no queues? All the schools are closed. It's a bank holiday. You know, you forget. You get into that just whirlwind or the hamster wheel of racing. And when it's up, listen, it's the way I want it, to be honest. The busier we are, the happier we are. And you can't, like I've always said with racehorses, especially 2-year-olds. I mean, they've only won thing in their head, and that's commit suicide. And your job is just to get in between them and killing themselves. If you're lucky enough then to hit on the sacred bridges of this world, just to mention one at the minute, a Dr. Zemp or something like that, just makes the job all the more sweeter. But I mean, they're few and far between, and you just have to appreciate them as they come along. I just love training 2-year-olds. Absolutely adore training 2-year-olds. And when you get a good one, it's brilliant.
That's something that could you explain that, Ger, like where the blank canvas of training a 2-year-old, not really ever yourself knowing where this horse might go, and that, you know, Ger was talking about his kids there, like they are kids as well, in respect you have to educate them and take baby steps.
Yeah, they are very much like kids, and I always train them as if they're kids. Like I always maintain, you know, the underage footballers, that they're naturally fit, so don't gallop the brains out of them. You know, it'd be the same with a 2-year-old. You know, you teach them, you educate them, and I always say to my guys here, if they get bad habits, you've given it to them, so be kind to them. And you know, you bring them along quietly, all in the one class, but slowly but surely, as the months pass or the weeks pass, you know, the best in the class comes to the front, and then you hope that the best in your class is the best in the class, but normally it isn't, you know. And then when you look at your best one go racing and it gets beat, as has happened many a time, then you know what you have back at the back is just selling class, and it's going to be a long year from that point, you know. But luckily enough, this year, I mean, I took the view that started this year that I was going to not rush the 2-year-olds, not that I ever do, but I was just going to let them come. And I said, as I said, if they're good in March, they'd be better in May, and they'd be better in April, and I'll just wait and wait and wait. But when I do launch them, they'll know their job, and thankfully they have done that. And you know, it's been a pleasure training the 2-year-olds this year, because more often than not, they've hit the target.
So is that this particular set of 2-year-olds, because like Aidan O'Brien trains Galileo is different to how he'll train a Warfront or whatever, but like, is that the 2-year-olds this year, or is it just Geraldine's side 2021 and going to freshen things up a bit?
I think it's 2021. I mean, I always take it handy with them, but I knew I had a nice, relatively nice bunch of 2-year-olds. They weren't precocious per se. You know, I wasn't going to have, you know, I knew I didn't have a Siskin or an Even So at 3. So I knew that if I was going to hit the top table this year, it was going to be with a 2-year-old. So I was going to let them all come and bring them along quietly and, you know, let them tell me when to start them. And I did. I didn't just put them in for the sake of it. So I can't, if I look at the board, I can't. Dr. Zemp started on the 2nd of June. So it was around Elzam 30. Around the end of May, the start of June, I started introducing the 2-year-olds, and they started, you know, and they started to run well, and then I knew then I had an above average bunch.
How many of them do you have?
60.
Wow, okay. So can you take us back even before that? When do you get them first?
Well, Kerry was at Doncaster last week. I don't think we bought anything last week. But that's the start of the sale season. And the Arcanos before that, we would have bought Cordiga Joe there last year, if that makes sense. But last year was a different year with the COVID. So we'd start normally Doncaster, work our way right through to book one, book two, book three, and that's the end of it, which is when end of October, November.
Okay, so this is a huge 8 weeks then for next year's crop of 2-year-olds.
Yeah, always the most important time of the year. It's the time I get most stressed, because you're spending money, and if you get it wrong, it's if it equated to your gig, you know, where you're always talking about football. I'm sourcing these, I'm scouting them. So if I buy a bad bunch, my league position is going to be fairly obvious early on in the season next year. Do you know what I mean? And it goes on for 2 to 3 years. So you know, it's not just your 2-year-old season is affected. If you don't have a good 2-year-old, you don't have a good 3-year-old.
Right.
So Kerry's taken after her dad then, in that she's obviously quite selective. She made the rare distinction of getting a flight to a different country, and just either budget wise or whatever, it just didn't fit for that particular week.
Yeah, we played, but we didn't get. But we have to, and we say it every year, we have to be very disciplined. You know, as the years pass, we have to be more and more disciplined. And I know what I want. I know what I'm aiming for. Sometimes I'll get it, sometimes I won't. But if I don't get it, I'm not just going to go for the next one in the shop. Do you know what I mean? And we're in a fortunate position, Johnny, that, you know, I've got some lovely home breeders sending me some lovely horses. So it's not as if, like back in the day, if I didn't purchase, I didn't have anything to train. Whereas now, if I don't purchase, which won't be the case, but if I don't purchase, I'm going to get some nice horses sent to me anyway. And it means that my bank is still full, so that if I find a nice two-year-old at a breeze, or I find something on our travel, somebody rings me in the interim next spring and says, I have something down here, can we bring it down to the gallop and show you, that we'll have the budget to buy it. So that's the position we're in at the moment.
When you're talking about the crop not being precocious per se, is that on purpose? Do you buy horses that aren't already showing because, I don't know, maybe there's a tendency for those prices to be somewhat, for those horses to be somewhat overpriced if they are precocious?
No, it's purely down to the budget, Ger. You buy what you're allowed to buy, give or take. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I'll have ideas what I want. I mean, in the real world, you'd like to be rocking and rolling and hitting the Coventry and hitting all the railway stakes and hitting the Phoenix and all that. But it's one thing saying you're going to hit all them, another thing going in and trying and buying them, you know.
And again, in terms of the trying to build an arsenal to attack the next season and the three-year-old season, do you focus on a specific distance, or do you want a range? You want sprinters, you want middle distance horses, and then you want some that'll be able to go over the longer distances?
It depends on the sale you're in. Like, I mean, Doncaster historically was always been for the precocious early two-year-old, and that has changed over the years. Like, we would have bought Nicky Jack Cave there, which isn't what you'd call a Doncaster specialist. You know, he ended up being a winner of a Saddle Bag at four and gone on down to Australia. So that's not what you go to Doncaster to look for. Historically, Doncaster would be for them early two-year-olds to get out and rock and roll. And then you'd be looking at the Orby and book one and book two for the other guys, you know, that would step up and be sort of being introduced at this moment in time for the 7 furlong and type of race, a 7 furlong plus. But the last few years, I found, like, I at the start of my career, I was getting the early, you know, first season sires that had speed. And then that changed where I couldn't get them. And now in the last few years, we're seeming to have a lot more. Like, at the start of my career, I didn't have many 12 furlong horses, 10, 12 furlong horses. Whereas of late, we get plenty of them, you know, that we buy ourselves, I should say.
Right.
And it just seems to be that the taste or the fashion has gone, that all the, you know, when Shadwell were in town and I picked to say a nice Dark Angel, well, you knew you were going to get outbid. If it wasn't by Shadwell, it was going to buy another, you know, Richard Hannon or Richard Fahey, or even the Breeze Up guys have become very predominant at the sales in recent years, you know. So so you cut your cloth. It's as simple as that. You cut your cloth. But the secret being that if you don't see what you like, or you just don't buy for the sake of it.
Yeah.
I'd rather come home empty than come home with a bunch of Vauxhall Conference players.
And is one of the differences about being successful now as well, I guess, or in your early days, you wanted horses that were going to run across the course of the season as well, so that there would be income coming if, you know, things were going well in the early part of the year and the middle part of the year. But like, you get to be more discerning as you get more successful.
Yeah, funny enough, I'd love to be that clever to look you in the eye and say, yeah, I was always thinking about the income going through right to the end of the season. I never once thought of the income. It was always about the winners. It was always about winners on the board. And I mean, if I was getting winners on the board, I would hope that the income was sorting itself out. But no, it was never. I don't have that financial brain on me that I can plot and plan economically. You know, I do it with the wall here, with the winners on the wall, and it's set up that I'm hoping that we're consistently churning out winners, and for me, consistency speaks volumes.
And has that changed over the years? In that, like, are you buying more to win than buying more to sell?
No, unfortunately, Johnny. I mean, I'm very. These horses, I mean, you have to sell. It was proven last year with Siskin and with Even So, and you can see all the big, you know, even the other day, our horse, a Moygler horse, is sold. The way the prize money is set up here in England and Ireland, so just wrapped a 2-in-1, as when I say up here in this jurisdiction, we have to sell. The prize money is pathetic. No matter what spin they put on it, the prize money is pathetic.
Even in Ireland?
So, Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you have to sell. You just can't. You can't. I can't look you in the eye as an owner and say to you, I'll win you that type of money. So I can't encourage you not to sell. You know, like the big days are great. You know, like typical me, I won two classics last year when the prize money was cut in bits. So that's a regret. So we're going to have to address that balance and do it again. But unfortunately, when you have Hong Kong, or fortunately, so it's how you sit at the desk and how you look at it. Without Hong Kong and Australia, you don't have that market. Without that market, you can't sell to go back to market, if that makes any sense. So it's a chicken and egg sort of thing. So if you're lucky enough to have, I mean, if I was a racehorse in Glen Burnie, I'd be having a chat with all the string and I'd be saying, whatever you do, don't win, he'll sell you.
Well, just to call you on that, because like you have a situation where you mentioned Hong Kong, so they've effectively a different kind of funding system there. You have a situation in Saudi Arabia. We had David Egan on, and as much and all, it was great that he won the Saudi Cup. I thought it was absolutely obscene that they were racing for $20 million when, you know, there are literally kids over the border in Yemen starving. For example, in Ireland, our prize money is based on the government partly, and also obviously the levy. It's not a situation that we can even take for granted.
No, of course we don't. We don't take it for granted, but I still don't think we should be on our bended knees apologizing and thanking everybody for the government stepping in and paying. They're only paying us what we're due, Johnny. Mm. You know, this industry pays its way hugely. You know, if we were to keep all of our what we earn on betting, keep it within the industry like they do in Hong Kong, the government wouldn't need us, wouldn't have to step in and help us. You know, our industry would be very, very self-sustaining if we had control of where the betting was going. Mm. Do you understand? Like, mm. I mean, but that ship has sailed, and brighter people than me would have to address this to get it back to that. Like, there's a lot of money leaking out. Like, all you've got to see, there was some CEO of some big firm in Britain. She's actually still living in Britain. I can't give you the name of the firm because I'd quote the wrong one, but I think her personal tax bill was 590 million sterling.
Yeah, this is going to be a serious, serious problem in Britain now, because you saw this week that they're basically trying to mess with their own handicap system because they got such a drubbing from the Irish at Cheltenham. But when you have like the Arab owners who are either leaving or passing away, and prize money in Britain 100% is absolutely pathetic, and you have a situation where they don't really know how to fund the product over there, and people are increasingly betting on other stuff. Like we're entirely reliant on British racing, effectively. Like, we wouldn't survive without it. Yes, the situation for British racing going forward is seriously perilous, I would argue.
We wouldn't survive without British racing. We are who's we?
Well, Irish racing, like the two are basically intertwined between jockeys, trainers, breeding, and so on and so forth. Like, if racing were off the map in Britain, where would it be in Ireland?
It'd be top of the map as it is. You know, I mean, don't confuse jump racing with flat racing. I mean, we have our own program over here. I rarely go over unless I have to, so we'd survive away. I mean, if they didn't have racing in Britain, they'd bet on ours, and as long as the money was coming into the game, the game would thrive. You know, the problem in Britain is they've too much racing. It's as simple as that. And you can see that over here, that, you know, we're beholden to the people who, with the purse strings, and we have to dance according to the jig that they ask us to dance. If they ask us to race at midnight, we have to race at midnight. And I don't think that's right. It's the way of the world. Our authorities need to try and address it, but has that ship sailed? But ultimately, what you're saying, like, don't get me wrong, on a Saturday and Champions Weekend, and we have plenty of with good prize money, not great prize money, and the cuts that we've made in recent years, they haven't come back to what they were. Do you know what I mean? But ultimately, in Britain, there's too much ordinary racing, chaff racing, you know. Then you've got they're trying their best, and I'm not getting involved in the politics of what's going on over there, but they try their best with the racing league. They're trying to innovate and but I think they're trying to do the wrong thing, in the sense, like, anything that brings more money into the game is to be applauded, be it a racing post bonus, a book one bonus, a breeze up bonus, whatever. The Ballyhane Stakes in Nace, fantastic initiatives. But and there's plenty of lads out there that are thinking outside the box to make those things happen. But ultimately, I mean, I'm a traditionalist. I've no interest in watching green, blue, red, pink colours coming up a straight line. I love looking at this, at the picture and seeing, say, Khaled Abdullah's colours, Sheikh Mohammed's colours, the Aga Khan's colours, JP's colours, Smurfit's colours, whatever. I just like, because the minute you see the colours, you associate with them. And then, you know, you could, oh, that's this and that's that. Whereas I'm just looking at, like, the, for me, what I seen at the Racing League was like greyhound racing. You're looking at trap stall numbers. 1, 2, 3, 4 trap numbers. And then you just basically call it, like they do in America, you call it the numbers. I don't think that's where we should be going. You know, like the least our owners deserve, you know, they're getting pushed further and further away from the trough. And the, I think the least they deserve is their colours. Mm. You know, and the recognition of their colours. That's in my opinion. And
isn't one of the ways to do that to explain about the bloodlines and to educate people? Because certainly as somebody who has come to the sport as an outsider over the last number of years, sitting here every Friday talking to people, one of the most interesting things is listening to people like you explain how that process works and what you're looking for when you're going to those sales and how the bloodline is important and how, you know, if by the alchemy of breeding, you create a third entity, there's the mother, the father, and the whatever it is that comes next, and how you train that. I think they're the stories that are going to bring people, you know, lifelong fans to the sport. The casual sports fan is obviously going to be sitting on the couch flicking, and you do need something to attract them in, and that's, you know, every media
company. I'm glad you said that, Joe, because in recent years, through marketing, people have gone with their concerts. They're bringing people in. I'm one of the people who believe that look after the guys inside the gate. And if they see, if those outside the gate see us having fun, they will gradually join us. Okay, they mightn't join us at the rate of knots that the PR people want them to join us, hence they're putting on concerts, etc. But I also believe that the concerts, etc., that have been put on have brought a different element to the racetrack that shouldn't be there. You know, so you'll have those for, you'll have those against. I remember, and I've had this discussion with you before, I'm sure, that when I was growing up, I was in awe of Lester Piggott, Pat Edry, Willie Carson, Cassius Mewson, all coming over with their tans after the winter away, wherever it was. It wasn't access all areas. So you had to go to Leopardstown at the start of the flat to see them. And then there they were with their tan skin riding around, but they were just out of touch. And because I was such a fan of racing, you know, I was into the mystique of it all. But nowadays it's access all areas. Jockeys are doing this blog, that blog for this betting firm, that betting firm. And we've just become, as I said, too accessible. And the mystique has been taken out of it. Now,
kind of the modern world, isn't it?
It's the modern world. We didn't have this TV. Like back in the day, I'd have to go up to the bookie shop and play and listen to the race. I couldn't see it. I'm sitting here talking to you on a television in the corner waiting to watch the next race that comes up. You know, and that's fantastic.
You can't have it everywhere. You can't. To be honest, I have been a concert goer at racetracks, and I actually totally understand why that whole entertainment part of the sport is hugely important too. And there's no point in us going too much further back and forth than that. But what sucked you into the sport in the first place? Because I think that's the bit, like, it's actually a massive amalgamation of different things that attract somebody in. And I think it's hard, but people are trying to make the sport as accessible as they can.
I wanted to be a jockey. So it was always the mystique of the champions, of the big names coming into town. That's where I'd be at the parade ring watching them and looking at them and in awe of them. And you know, you'd read the Dick Francis books, at least I did. And then you'd reenact them, watching these guys.
Not the murders, hopefully.
You know, but it was all so real to me. And
So just on that, briefly, right? Because we went racing as kids to the Curragh. My best mate growing up was connected to a racing family. We would have gone to the Curragh. And once you get there, you can't but be impressed by the size and the scale and the pageantry. And I think you're right about the colours, 100%. But I think just get people to it. Get as many people as you can to it. And like if they're not into it after they've actually been down at the parade ring and watched the horse, whatever, if it's jumps or if it's flat, whatever, like that's the power of the sport right there. You can get very close. I know you're saying they're just out of reach, but like, the parade ring is super close. As sports go, you don't get any closer in any sport to the participants.
But what I would do as a pro now, who's been there, done that, and bought the T-shirt, I would re-educate. If we go back to the London Olympics, for want of a better word, do you remember they had, I don't know what the official term they gave them, but they were welcomers. They were all the happy people. The volunteers who met you with a smile on their face and pointed you in the right direction, made sure you weren't lost, but made sure your experience was fantastic. That's what I wanted Irish races. To me, there's too many bouncers at races. You know, too many, you can't come here, you're at the wrong entrance, go there. You know, straight away you have a bad taste in your mouth. So for me, the racetracks need to re-educate their staff on that front. Instead of the high-vis yellow jackets, it's grand. Just remind them that they're not bouncers, that they are there to help our customers whom we've helped bring to the front door. So please don't turn them away by being rude to them. You know, if they happen to be, and there'll always be those who try their hand, I think that's grand. But if they happen to turn up at the wrong entrance, encourage them that this is where you should be going, and point them in the right direction. But leave them feeling good about themselves, not small about themselves. So that's what I would do personally.
Well, the stars of the show at a race meet, James Joyce said the only decent people I ever met at a race meeting were the horses. But the stars of the show are the horses. What we need to do is educate kids to love horses. Forget about gambling. Just bring school kids to Gerline's Yard, maybe a couple of times a year, or bring them to any yard around County Meath, their local yard, and a load of them will just fall in love with horses.
I've offered that in local areas. It's never been taken up, but I would do that with a heart and a half. Mm. I mean, I've always maintained that. I mean, we're set up to do it. You're not in the way, you know. I've always maintained that I could handle school children coming around. I often ask the question, should I be going around doing a speak every now and then to classes, just to, you know, with a video presentation, just to teach that, you know, what we're about. But when I was growing up in my class, say of 40, 39 and a half of them wanted to be jockeys. You know, nowadays, I doubt you'll have one of them in the whole school wanted to be a jockey or involved in racing. It's just not that way anymore. It's because of the TV, it's social media. There's so much more entertainment for these kids. But back in our time, it was relatively more simple, wasn't it? In my opinion, it was anyway. When we were in Clane and the GA would run the pony donkey derbies, all the champions came down, all the jump jockeys came down and the flat jockeys, and they'd end up having a donkey derby. It was the highlight of the year. Yeah. You know, for me anyway, that's what I was into. Yeah, it was simpler, but wasn't it fantastic? You know,
I think all that stuff is definitely, people are pining for a community, and people are pining for something that is straightforward. And I think there's big opportunities in what you're saying. I think the idea of the volunteers is a great idea, because like, loads of people would love to do it. We're a nation of busybodies. Are you okay? Can I help you?
Yeah, 100%. Rather than say you're at the wrong entrance now, bugger off and get your act together and don't turn up here again, because that's the way it is, and it's happened to me.
We have a challenge to get people racing, for sure. It's
don't leave a bad taste in their mouth by the first, you know, the minute they get out, you know, feeling stupid about themselves that they've gone to the wrong entrance. You know, please, just, we have gone to the effort. We, being the industry, have gone to the effort to say, please. Like, I'm told Champions Weekend went online today and sold out immediately. So somebody has gone to the effort to get that 4,000 people to boat codes next Saturday and Sunday. So don't turn them away by being over officious. You know, somebody's going to make a mistake. Somebody's going to wheel up at the wrong entrance. Put an arm around them and say, listen, welcome. This is where you should be. Have a great day, blah-de-blah. And I don't think that should be, you know, above and beyond the call of duty.
You obviously had a bad experience in one instance. I'm sure the race courses, just for balance, would be on saying that the vast majority of their patrons, when they're all coming back, will be welcomed like that. But look, I think that that's probably an issue in Irish hospitality generally across the board. Can we go back to you? Because I'm interested in there was one thing that always struck me about that Manchester United team that had Roy Keane under Alex Ferguson was that they always made sure that they celebrated. There was a big night out that got out of hand, but they went on a massive night out when they won a League Cup. And I could never really understand why they took the celebration of the League Cup so seriously. But Keane always said, when you win something, you have to celebrate because it actually binds everybody together and it reminds you why you do it in the first place. Are you in that position at all at the moment? In retrospect, my first question about did you get to look back after the 1,000 winners? You're in this 8-week period now, which is obviously one of the most tense 8 weeks that you have, because if you get this right, then the next couple of years are going to be great. But maybe after that, is there a celebration at some point where you go, when you win the classics? Is there a
We won the classics last year and the staff all met us and the horses when they came home, and we had a bottle of champagne in the kitchen. And that was the extent of it, but we were in COVID.
Socially distanced, so, bottle of champagne.
Yeah, we were all working together anyway, but we can't and couldn't do anything about that. That said, it's not our style. You know, my head lad has been here since he's 13. Our relationship is based on the fact that we don't speak to each other.
It's better than being married to someone with that relationship, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if he talks to me, there's a problem. If I talk to him, there's a problem. So, and we certainly won't socialize together. So it's not broke, so we won't try and fix it. But that said, I did say the other day, said we must do something. We must do something when all this nonsense is over. Just to say thank you, because it is good and that. But I mean, lads, I'm the most boring person on planet Earth.
I don't drink.
I don't drink, and if I get into a room where there's people drinking,
you turn the other way.
Well, when they start repeating themselves, I have to disappear. I just have to
That's
disappear.
That's fair enough. That is fair enough. I don't even mean about drinking so much. It's just like the bit where the achievement is recognized internally. And
I could feel they were all proud. I think it is, but we're not going to get an open top bus and go around for messing. We're not that type. And I think the next day, you know, like Lynn was the one who was on top of the numbers. And if you're relying on me now, A, I'd have got it wrong and we'd have been celebrating 3 years ago. I would have thought I did it ages ago, and I'm a bit disappointed with myself that it took so long. But anyway, when it happened, yeah, there was a nice feeling in the yard, but we've a job to do and we've still horses to run and the season isn't over, and I'm in a close battle to stay on top of with Jesse and Joseph and Aiden at the top of the trainers table. So that's important to us. It's only numbers, I know, but that's what ego does to you guys.
Well, that's a good thing though. That's going to drive you on for the rest of the year as well. So the 1,000 wasn't it, but say at the end of the season, if things were to break your way, and I'm not putting any jinx on it or anything, but at that point, how do you reflect on satisfaction and the job well done without it? Because it doesn't sound like anything is ever going to make you complacent. This isn't a job, it's a lifestyle. And you know, you're like one of the artists who has to paint. You're going to be doing this until you die, it sounds like.
I did an interview the other day with Brian O'Connor, and he sort of, I don't know what I must have said, but he says, so you're not going to retire. And I said, Brian, trainers don't retire, they die. You know, and my life, I feed the horse at 5 o'clock in the morning. We kick on, say, 6:30 or 7 o'clock whenever the staff come in. I'm finished at 11, say 11:30, 12 at the very latest. I have a snooze. I do whatever I have to do in the afternoon. Yesterday, I was cycling up around Glendalough. Today, I have runners in the first in Down Royal, so I'll watch that. Normally, wherever, I'll watch my runners. I mean, what else would you be doing in retirement that's better than that? You know, so basically, you're working in retirement anyway. You know, I'm my own boss. I can come and go as I please, and this is the way we choose to live. But
you've a runner in 6 minutes.
In
6 minutes. I'm going to let you go there because I.
No, you're grand. The beautiful thing about these phones is you can watch them back.
Yeah,
that's great. So where do you do your thinking then? Because obviously there's loads of stuff going on in your head.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah.
Cycling around Glendalough.
Welcome to that problem. I mean, the problem with Europe is to not think, is to stop thinking. And when yesterday I really enjoyed this cycle up there and up and down Dales, and you tend to forget about about whatever it is you were thinking about. The secret to me is, well, for Jer, is definitely to try and get me to stop thinking.
So how do you do that?
With great difficulty. With great difficulty. Just keep busy. Just keep busy. But I'm always thinking. But I think, isn't everybody? You've always something going on in your head. At the minute, Jer, and it's not painting this, I don't know, blasé picture. I don't mean to do that. At the minute, I'm very chuffed with what's going on. I'm very proud of the way the horses are running. I'm very proud of what's been achieved. And I feel good about myself and I feel good about the yard. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
so
well,
it's good.
The point you made earlier on about 4 or 5 years ago, or maybe a little bit longer, there was a few changes and success started to come. That was the bit where the overnight success happened after 15 or 35 years. And all the hard work that you paid got you into a groove where you were able to plan slightly longer term. And the quality of the horses improved collectively. So you were getting the reward for the work that you were putting in.
Yeah, listen, winners, consistency brings your name to the attention of those owners. And then if you're lucky enough to get those owners, then obviously the quality of your string is going to improve. If the quality of your string improves, your strike rate is going to improve. And it's a chicken and egg thing, you know. Problem with me was I was in too much of a rush back in 94. I wanted where I am right now back then and didn't realize that it doesn't work like that, you know, and that's what made me an angry little ant trying to in a rush to where I was going, you know. That's called growing up and getting older.
Well, that was my last question. Having reached this milestone, and I accept that it's obviously a bit constructed compared to where you want to be at the end of the year, there's other prizes on offer. What would you tap the Jer Lyons of 94 on the shoulder and say now, if you had him in the room to improve what was coming afterwards, what would you do differently?
Just relax, chill out, don't be in such a rush, listen, you know, that'd be it. I mean, everything I've done back then made me who I am now, so I can't say I'd change what I did, but I'd love to have been not in such a rush, you know. If I could promise myself back then that this was guaranteed, maybe I would have been an easier person to live with to get there, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
You know.
Put yourself under too much pressure to do things in too short a time, and when they didn't happen, you beat yourself up over it. But actually, the work that you were doing made the success inevitable.
Yeah, I mean, when I didn't have a runner in the Derby or the Guineas or the thing back then, and I only had 3 horses to train, I was wondering what the hell was wrong. You know? But that's the only thing you'd say, because other than that, the experience from there to here has made Glenburnie what it is, you know, and we've survived it, which is more important. You know, it'd be a different kettle of fish if we didn't survive it, which was looking likely for quite a while.
Sometimes I think the quality of surviving the bad times is completely underrated in all our lives. When you look back at the stuff that you've come through, you go, yeah, I survived that. That's actually more impressive than anything else.
Exactly, 100%. And it makes this, as I said, the good feeling feel, you know, it's grand. But we're not jumping up and down. I'm not trying to present an image of, you know, we're all cool about it here. It's not. It's a huge achievement by a whole load of people over a number of years. But we're a long ways from finished. Like, basically, my theory is, by the time I hit Kevin's age, I should hit the 2000 mark. That's the plan.
That's 88, is it?
Yeah, I think that would be achievable. And anything before that would be acceptable. And if we're still healthy and sane at the end of that, I think that would be something worth celebrating.
Well, hopefully we'll get you on before then. But if the next time we speak to you is after your 2000 winner and you're 88, things have gone pretty well for you. Jer, it's great to talk to you as ever. It's been really enjoyable. Thanks a million.
Good luck in the first.
Super, lads. Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Cheers. Cheers. Take care. That's Jer Lyons there. Friday Night Racing is brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Just one of the most interesting characters that we have on the show, covering any of the sports that we have, you know?
Just looking at his strike rate there for this season, it's like he'd 65 winners last season. He's already on 62, and we've just started September. 20% strike rate in Ireland. Like, that is absolutely phenomenal going. I mean, it's not... I've kind of made the analogy before about Kilkenny hurlers raising the standards that we now have maybe with Limerick today, but it is like that in Ireland because it's very, very hard to compete with Coolmore and Ballydoyle. It's really hard to compete. Like, so he won his first classic last year, for example.
Exactly. So just explain this for people who, because we have a lot of people who watch us on Friday afternoons, listen on Friday evenings, who are casual enough sports fans, but just put that in context because he's genuinely up against Man City, Man United, Barcelona and Real Madrid in Ireland alone.
Yeah, it's like, who's... Andre Agassi's misses
Steffi Graf.
So if Andre Agassi and Steffi Graf effectively have four kids and you have kids, who do you expect to be a better tennis player? Like they're going to make good tennis players. Like, and Galileo makes incredibly good racehorses. They have Galileos and nobody else really has. And Galileo is by far the most dominant force in European racing, full stop. He's now passed away. The legacy of him will live on forever. But very few trainers have Galileos except Aidan O'Brien. Coolmore has basically they have the best horses in the world to go to stud with. And Gerlines has to shop around. He has to get owners. The horse he mentioned there, Sacred Bridge, is by Bated Breath, who wouldn't be a top stallion necessarily. And you have to kind of pick and choose. But he works incredibly hard. He says he doesn't drink, but I think he gave up the drink probably because he's like, to be the best trainer in the world, I have to give this absolutely everything. And like, he rises before dawn every single day. Not many will do that. And he's just an incredibly successful person. I don't think he's probably acknowledged in terms of Irish sporting appreciation. Maybe he's acknowledged in racing, but what he does as a trainer is phenomenal.
Yeah, so it's like, it's not easy for any of the trainers who have access to the great stallions, because it's obviously incredibly hard work, but it's even more difficult to build something up to a level. It's kind of, for the football analogy, it's kind of Leicester City, right?
Yeah. Now they
qualify for the Champions League.
He obviously has very good staff. I think we went through that entire 45 minutes without mentioning Colin Keane.
Yeah,
which
we should have done, yeah.
And that's no slight on Ger, because I spoke to Colin during the week as part of the Champions Weekend launch, and like, Ger actually let Colin Keane ride for Dermot Weld. Like, when he reckons that his horse isn't going to win, he lets Colin Keane ride for a rival. I think that's a measure of the man. It's very, very fair, because in theory he's kind of harming himself by doing that, but he probably acknowledges that Colin is a world-class jockey, and to have him at all is a good thing.
Yeah, and it's good quality management. It's the putting your ego aside for the greater good.
Exactly.
And that, in turn, you get it back, which, you know, you don't see a lot in, you know, my way or the highway. The macho world of big-time sport frequently doesn't allow for decisions like that to be made. So, I think it's good that we take the time to celebrate the 1,000 winners, even if he's busy fretting about what next year's two-year-olds are going to look like and how quickly this year's two-year-olds are maturing.
You may have mentioned Roy Keane there. There is an element of Roy Keane about Ger in that I don't know if Roy Keane derived an awful lot of enjoyment from winning. I think he just hated losing, and like, he didn't... Like,
do you know, I think that's the public... I think he loved it.
Did he?
Yeah, he did. All those nights out.
Well, he wasn't having nights out post, what, 2000s? So it was like, for Roy Keane,
I think actually...
Well, certainly he didn't gorge on victories. It was like, where's the next game?
But I think that's not true. I think that my point there was that in the books, actually, they ended up having massive nights out after winning the League Cup. And you're like...
Yeah, he was brilliant with Gary Neville about that, to be fair.
Why would you be celebrating these? And like, you know,
I think there's an insatiable desire to win more.
There's also a famous incident where everybody's complained about somebody celebrating a League Cup later on, and they're, oh, we don't celebrate these. But I think that's also kind of fake. There was it? I'm trying to think now. It might have been Rio Ferdinand's book.
We're really digressing here.
We are.
Basically, my point was true, and let's move on.
Okay. Gold, silver and bronze positions in our tote tend to follow remain as is, with Tom Malone comfortably in the lead. He's getting gold, followed by me in second, and you, Johnny, in third. How's that silver looking? Sweet. Tastes nice. Will Longines Irish Champions Weekend disrupt the standings and give us a new leader? No. I think the leader is baked in, trapped to line.
Yes.
Tom Malone.
Yes, indeed.
The Saturday of Longines Irish Champions Weekend will also see the first ever Whirlpool on Irish racing. Whirlpool brings together betting activity from tote operators around the world, meaning vastly increased tote pools, which will present unique opportunities for Irish punters betting on Leopardstown. Visit tote.ie to find out more about the Whirlpool. We've been talking about this over the last couple of weeks, trying to simplify what it actually means for the commoner garden punter. Basically, bet with the tote if you're going to bet on Leopardstown next week.
Yeah, I thought like there would be more of an international dimension to the Champions Stakes. To be honest, you know, I like to promote racing, whatever. The Champion Stakes isn't going to be the race I thought it would be. It looks like an all Irish cast. So the pool, if you had, now there wouldn't necessarily going to be a runner from Japan, which there has been before, but there will be a lot of money wagered on the race. And if you are having a bet, make sure to look at the pool, because it's not like going to Harold's Cross on a Monday night back in the day and putting 20 quid on the dog to place because the odds were wrong, and then returning like 6-1 on because there's no money in the pool. There will be a load of money in the pool, so your bet's not going to influence the market.
Okay. All right. That is this week's edition of Friday Night Racing in the books. If you want to get in touch, you can leave a comment on the YouTube stream, or of course you can always text the show on a Friday evening on 53106. We broadcast every Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock on all of Off the Ball social channels, so youtube.com/offtheball, and you can hit subscribe on that. The best place to get us these, as of course, is on the OTB Sports app. And Friday Night Racing and Off the Ball is brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Love every racing moment. Visit hri.ie.
Friday Night Racing
on Off the Ball,
brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Love every racing moment. Visit hri.ie.
Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.